Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Joining us today is my good friend, Sam Bendett of the Center for Naval Analyses. He's also affiliated with the Center for a New American Security, as well as the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's one of the world's leading experts on the Russian military, Russia, as well as unmanned systems. Sam, always an honor and pleasure having you on the program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Always great to be back, Vago.
Indeed, a pleasure. And before we get started, our coverage of strategy and conversations with leading national security thinkers is sponsored by General Atomics Aeronautical Systems and devoted to the memory of one of the nation's greatest national security strategists, the late, great Andy Marshall, the former director of the Pentagon's Office of Net Assessment. This strategy series is not affiliated with the Andrew W. Marshall Foundation. Sam, it's clear that Ukraine is under pressure as U.S. aid has effectively stopped. Russia is continuing to field more of just about everything from the old, like artillery shells, to the new, like new long-range precision strike drones, and now even guided conventional bombs. What's the latest on the war and where do we stand? Because there is a lot of focus, especially after the fall of Avdiivka, how the front is moving. The Ukrainians even have admitted we're inching back in some places. How does that line of contact look to you in the wake of Avdiivka?
Well, it's true Ukrainians are inching back, but they're not actually falling back. And there are no significant breakthroughs at the front still, and probably won't be for quite a while. Russians did capture Avdiivka, but after that, their advance was rather incremental. And all of this is due to the fact that the stalemate-like situation continues, with both sides still arrayed in a fairly equal manner against each other. And as we refer to almost every single time we have these discussions, the presence of numerous ISR elements on the front make any significant collection of forces and movement of forces highly unlikely. So both sides still maintain a significant amount of ISR drones, FPV drones, kamikaze drones of different types and ranges. And so right now, Ukrainians have a lot of grounds to be concerned because the Russians haven't been dented by their massive losses. They haven't been deterred by sanctions, and they're still very much in the fight. And there are indications that they're actually improving some of their tactics. So there's a lot to be concerned about, but we're not expecting any massive or significant breakthrough anytime soon.
The war still looms large, and certainly the Washington consciousness. The president obviously let off his State of the Union address on it, and in the president's budget request yesterday, there was about $4 billion, $3.9 billion for the European Deterrence Initiative, as well as a whole bunch of other capability investments down to weapons. Obviously, it's been delayed. What kind of signal do you think that the president is starting off the State of the Union? Right. I mean, what impact did that have both, do you think, domestically as well as globally?
Well, I think it was a very significant message to the world. And obviously here domestically that the U.S. president is starting off his State of the Union address discussing Ukraine and U.S. aid to Ukraine. So obviously it's a very powerful message. But as we know, this is the presidential election year and a lot of messages and a lot of good intentions, especially in foreign policy, really get mangled in the political process. And so the U.S. president message to his party, to other supporters of Ukraine, that this is going to be an important issue. Obviously, all of this will have to be discussed at length and in great detail and debated in Congress and in various political races that will unfold across the country. So I think there's still a lot of fight left to convince a lot of people in the United States that this fight matters.
I love talking to you because we can go everything from the tactical up to the geostrategic and even down to the more granular level. There is a concern that as the United States delays the fielding of more aid, that Vladimir Putin is becoming more empowered. And there are folks who looked at the missile strike last week where Russia dropped a ballistic missile, dropped it on Odessa, 300 feet from where Vladimir Zelensky was hosting the Greek prime minister. Is there, you know, the Russians maintain they were going after a naval drone warehouse. But there are others who don't really believe that and think that this was sort of a message more broadly. From your standpoint, is there a broader message there? And is this a Vladimir Putin who feels a little bit more empowered that I can pretty much do anything I want in Ukraine at this point?
I think this was definitely a message. It is very difficult to imagine that a strike of this kind at a time and a place that it happened was a mere accident. But look, coincidences do happen. What we do have to consider, and what we have discussed before, and what your listeners were exposed to essentially, is that Russian president has no opposition. There's no effective counter to his policies. And the last effective opposition was in June of last year in the so-called Prigozhin uprising, which fizzled very quickly. So the Russian president can craft whatever policies he wants without really any significant pushback from civil society, from other political parties, and certainly from within his own circle. And he has been empowered in that way for quite a while. The Prigozhin uprising, mutiny, whatever we want to call it, was just a blip on the radar. It really wasn't a pattern. It was rather a very significant exception. And so right now, he feels that as United States political establishment is trying to debate the aid to Ukraine, as the European establishment is trying to scramble military production and other policies to aid Ukraine, he feels that he can just wait this process out. Again, there was no opposition to him for hundreds of thousands of deaths of young Russian men on this battlefield. And so there won't be any significant opposition to him going forward.
Is there any pushback from, right? I mean, Morozov was basically forced to commit suicide in reporting the Avdiivka casualties. And right, I mean, if you can kill Alexei Navalny, you can kill anybody, which is the message really that you're sending. But one of the things that we've discussed, and, you know, folks say, you know, even in this presidential election with one guy running, is the mothers and pressure from mothers. Is that having any impact, or are the generous death benefits, frankly, that everybody gets, right? I mean, I've seen interviews with Russians who say, look, my kid would have died of, you know, an alcoholic in a jail in 38, and I got a nice ruble payout.
So yeah, and
for some,
payouts,
it's a decent trade-off.
Yeah, but again, it's those payouts are uneven across the board, and right, some people are not getting anything at all. Yes, the wives and the mothers of soldiers are sort of a public face to this war, in the sense that the Russian society still has a lot of people who are very concerned about what's going on. But as far as Telegram is concerned, and we talked about it in 2022 when the war started, we certainly raised this issue last year, and we're raising it again. It's an information source where people can still get relatively accurate news about the war, but all of the bloggers, all the correspondents, all the military reporters, all the commentators, all of the volunteer efforts who are on Telegram, I think are right now being very careful about outright criticism of the Russian military action or highlighting any significant deficiencies. You still get people talking about comms and electronic warfare as a problem. You still get people talking about other sort of technical, tactical, mechanical issues, but it's not like an overarching political discussion and debate that was happening in some way in 2022 amongst all of these Telegram channels, when they were freely discussing all the detriments and all of the significant losses that the Russian military has suffered. But we don't get that anymore. We probably will not get that. And anyone who steps out of line, like the blogger Morozov, is going to basically end up in one way and one way only. So again, this is a president engaged in a large-scale conventional conflict with lots of casualties, and there's no pushback in the Russian society against Russian deaths, or obviously as there's no pushback for everything he's doing to Ukraine on a daily basis as well at home. Most people accept this war. Most people agree with this war. If they don't agree with it, they're staying quiet. People who do not agree have already voted with their feet and left the country. Some were forced to come back. We've seen that as well. So again, this is a president without any significant political opposition to any of his policies which have to do with the war in Ukraine.
Let me go to something a little more granular. One of the highlights of the South by Southwest conference innovation meeting in Austin every year are not just the technology panels, the innovation panels, and obviously there's art and music, but it's become a sizable military event as well. is the panel discussions with Ukrainians that we saw in 2022, 2023, and this year. I've unfortunately had to cover it remotely. And one of the things Ukrainians always point out is that they've prioritized quality while Russia has been more about quantity. But the problem now is, as we've discussed on this program, the Russians are also getting better quality and are being able to do it in greater volume. Ukrainians are still prioritizing quality, and they point out we would like to have quality with quantity. Where do we stand right now in this give and take, right? I mean, New York Times had an interesting story, I think today or yesterday, about, you know, effectively that the Russians are beginning to field a JDAM-like glide bomb capability with about 70 miles of range. Walk us through how these capabilities are emerging, because literally not a week goes by that something new doesn't pop up somehow on the battlefield. And we'll get to autonomy in a minute, but, you know, take that anywhere you want to take it.
We talked about this, I think, in the middle of last year when Ukrainian counteroffensive was coming to an end. And the issue we were raising in our discussion for the listeners is that if enough time passes, then the Russian military has enough leeway to hold Ukrainians off, as well as to start retraining the force, refurbishing its equipment, pulling things out of storage and modernizing them. And we would simply have enough time to kind of invest enough time and resources in its defense industry to start manufacturing exactly what was needed. And now, as we are in the third year of the war, it is very clear what kind of weapons are having the greatest impact. And because the Russian economy and the Russian industry are not impacted to any significant extent, when it comes to weapons manufacturing, I mean, it is impacted in some ways, but certainly the impact isn't enough to stop the production. Right. Now that it has mass scale production of different types of systems, we get a qualitative improvement in the types of weapons and systems that Russia has fielded, because it had enough time to review, to analyze, to iterate, and to essentially put the stuff in the field. And this, of course, involves loading munitions like Landsats, it involves missiles, it involves other systems which are currently in the field, and that's why Ukrainians are concerned.
I have to say, I mean, it was one of the most frustrating things about listening to the budget briefings on Monday was how many of the most important weapon programs that we've tried to accelerate, both whether to help our Ukrainian ally and partner, but also to better prepare against China, have been completely stalled because of Congress's inability to pass the 2024 defense plan, to pass this latest supplemental where it has a lot of weapons investment in it. One of the things that we heard in South by Southwest, which was sort of interesting, is the extent to which certainly Ukrainians have been using unmanned systems on the battlefield. We know that, you know, in terms of precision strike, right? Using, I think you were among the first to say that the Ukrainians really are substituting artillery shells with unmanned capability to be very, very precise. So they're not necessarily firing thousands of rounds while still taking out individual vehicles or taking out troop concentrations and the like. But also what we learned in South by Southwest was the extensive way the Ukrainians use drones for battlefield medicine, whether it's moving blood to people, right? I mean, one of the folks in one of the panel discussions said, the only thing we can move forward is an MRI machine, right? So there's a lot of autonomy that's being used here and a lot of capability. Where does that autonomy, right? I mean, this is the ultimate laboratory, isn't it, Sam? And where does autonomy now stand on the battlefield as each side is looking at cycle times of just a couple of weeks to field new capabilities, whether on the defensive side or on the offensive side?
I think I've quoted a Russian saying it earlier. If I haven't, I'm going to say it here. A lot of Russian commentators are saying that really it is Ukraine and Russia which are ahead of the entire world when it comes to unmanned and robotic and autonomous systems development and fielding. And the types of systems they're using right now in combat are essentially enabling them to really evolve on the fly, no pun intended, right? As the research and development and fielding and experimentation cycles have contracted to weeks, mere days, and sometimes even hours. So as you indicated, logistics is a very big deal. And because of a lot of combat drones present any significant logistics movements are going to be observed and attacked. And so medical evacuation supply runs are becoming very dangerous. So what we're seeing right now are heavy UAVs and even light quadcopters stepping in instead of trucks and light utility vans, essentially vessels for different types of supplies, ammo, medicine, water, food, and other needed items. Both sides are experimenting with light ground vehicles, unmanned ground vehicles that can also deliver supplies and even evacuate soldiers. A lot of these developments are actually happening at the front line. They are not coming from the military industrial complexes on both sides. They're actually a DIY type of systems where soldiers and volunteers can build something together from civilian components, put it in the field, see what works. Whatever doesn't work essentially gets discarded. And so that's why Ukraine right now is launching the army of UGVs, which is going to be essentially army of robots, as they call it, which will be based on its army of drones initiative, where multiple types of combat logistics unmanned ground vehicles are going to be put in the field. And most of these are going to be sort of mid to small size systems, which are essentially more relevant in combat than large heavy systems that could be tracked and destroyed by UAVs. So we have a lot of very interesting developments happening on both sides, and both sides are really pushing through with innovation. And so the lesson, of course, for the United States is how to do this quickly and efficiently in large-scale conventional war, when, as you have indicated, we have a lot of checks and balances, not only on our defense budget, but on the way we actually develop weapons and systems. Neither Ukraine or Russia actually are bound to such rules. And so they can build something very quickly. They can field something very quickly. So we have to see how Ukraine succeeds with its army of robots. And we have to see what the Russian response is going to be. It's very clear right now that a lot of these robotic and unmanned systems, which in many ways are still remote controlled and have a human in the loop, how they're substituting soldiers in some of the more dangerous missions. And if this actually goes to scale, if both sides field them in significant numbers, it may actually impact the battlefield, where there will be fewer and fewer humans conducting some of the more dangerous missions.
And walk us through, right, you and I, going back almost 7-8 years ago, we're talking about the development of Russia's ground robots and fielding stuff, and they sent some stuff to Syria, and it didn't work. They tried using some of these in Ukraine, and they sort of didn't work. Bring us up to speed on where the Russians are in the capability, and bring us up to speed also on some of the capabilities the Ukrainians, you know what I mean, like for like, how do they compare in terms of the capabilities they're trying to deploy on the ground?
So I think the biggest overarching theme here is that the big and the bulky and the few and the expensive are out, and the mass scale, smaller to mid-sized, cheap and expendable systems are in. So practically all of the UGVs we're seeing in the field on manned ground vehicles on both sides are relatively small, relatively cheap, and built with a lot of civilian components. Many of them are relatively brittle, meaning they're not really well protected against all manner of countermeasures, but they're not supposed to be, because a lot of them are built at the front lines right now. And so a lot of things we discussed and a lot of things that we talked about when it comes to Russian unmanned ground vehicle development, things I was writing about and talking about, really had a lot to do with those kind of few and bulky and large. In combat like Ukraine, anything big on the field is going to be observed, tracked, and ultimately hit with FPV drones. And when we were talking about Russian systems like Uran 9, like Saratnik, Nirekhta, a couple of others, systems based on BMP-3 vehicles or refurbished tanks, etc., these were large systems, and we were talking about their development and testing in the absence of weapons like FPV drones, which was really kind of a shock to the larger military global system starting in 2022, because no military has anticipated that this racing drone would have such a significant impact in a conventional type war that's unfolding in Ukraine. And so Russians still have a lot of these sort of large projects, but I think they've been put on the back burner because state news, Russian state news talks about, it talks a lot about logistics UGVs. It talks a lot about kind of smaller combat vehicles that could be built in large numbers and then obviously fielded in a way that they can be better protected and they can hide better from the ubiquitous intelligence surveillance and reconnaissance drones and FPV drones. But even that is obviously no panacea because FPV drones are everywhere. Their numbers are going to grow on both sides, and there will be a staggering amount of FPV drones present. And so that's going to impact how systems like UGVs are actually developed, whether they will come with a lot of electronic warfare and counter UAS systems, or they will essentially be built in a slightly different formula. But it is unlikely that we're going to see an Uran 9 combat UGV in Ukraine. The ones that Russians were testing in Syria, the ones that they were trying to experiment with in 2020 and 2021, because those systems are very expensive and they're very big. What you need is a lot of smaller, well-protected, and very cheap and attritable systems that can operate in large quantities.
Let me take you to the question of actually how much of this is autonomous. You know, as you said, FPV is first-person video. These are human operators that are using these systems, obviously with as protected comms links as you can. How many of the systems, of the tens of thousands, Sam, of aerial systems and ground systems and naval systems, how many of these are actually, what percentage of them are actually autonomous? The kind of autonomous system that we will need, for example, in the Indo-Pacific?
Practically none. Almost everything you see in Ukraine is flown by pilots. Right. And so the holy grail here would be to develop autonomy that would enable one pilot to control multiple types of UAVs or UGVs or even unmanned surface vessels, or that would allow one pilot to actually control a swarm. And so there's a lot of research happening on both sides on swarming applications. There are some limited sort of autonomy, machine vision applications for these drones that can minimize the communication between the pilot and the drone and therefore make it better protected against electronic warfare. But they are still human-in-the-loop technologies. And so practically all of them in the field are very much remote controlled and remote piloted. And so the next evolution in this war would be a move away from this remote piloting of these tens of thousands of systems to where they could be more autonomous and therefore more deadly.
Let me ask you we've got a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to ask you kind of a broad nuclear question. Peter Baker of the New York Times had a terrific story talking about why in October of 2022, the administration, which happened to be the 60th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis, became very concerned about some of the intelligence they were picking up about the prospect that the Russians would use nuclear weapons and the back channel messaging they used. And, you know, at the time, we even discussed this both on our Washington Roundtable, and you and I did. I think you, Eugene Rumer, and I even discussed it once about the messaging back and forth. From the Russians are very willing to turn that knob. And just a couple of weeks ago, we saw the Russians leak a report about how they would use nuclear weapons. And it had the desired effect, right? It caused Olaf Scholz to blink. When it came to giving Taurus cruise missiles to the Ukrainians, for example. And unfortunately, there was that leak of a conversation among German generals. From your standpoint, how do we need to think about Russians and nuclear weapon and their nuclear weapons and their nuclear rhetoric, given that each time we say we're worried, Putin knows that's a lever he can pull, doesn't he? I mean, how do we need to separate fact from fiction to get sort of the tough strategy that we need to get us to where we need to be and to actually deter him, as opposed to actually enable him by not passing Ukraine aid and also occasionally self-deterring ourselves?
Well, this is the real problem, isn't it? Every time he talks about it, we jump, and he knows that. Nuclear weapons use is a very significant issue for the U.S. policy community, for the NATO policy community, for the global community in general. And that obviously puts a lot of people on alert, whenever they're mentioned. What we've seen so far is a relatively sort of mute response from the Russian president. A lot of calls for the use of nuclear weapons are not necessarily coming from Putin himself. They're coming from some of the people in his circles and his entourage. And he's been urged to use nuclear weapons against Ukraine multiple times, and obviously he has resisted so far. So I don't have a good answer to it. I'm not a nuclear expert in this sense, and I'm not an expert on nuclear weapons. But it is a very scary thing when a president of a country with thousands of nuclear weapons casually remarks that nothing is off the table in this war, and that if things go sour for Russia, again, nothing is off the table, including nuclear weapons. So I don't know how to really wrap my mind around that. It's a very, very significant issue, and it's a very worrying issue.
As somebody, close to the administration, when I was sort of brushing it off, pointed out to me, Vago, that's not your decision to make. It's the president, and he can be as worried as he wants to be, because ultimately he's the one responsible, which I think is fair. Let me ask you one last question. Sweden yesterday became the 32nd member of the NATO alliance, hoisting its flag outside the alliance's headquarters in Brussels. And the Russians are still threatening a response somehow that, we will decide to attack Sweden whenever we want to attack, basically, is the message. It was the same message that came when Finland joined. How do we interpret that? Is that just rhetoric for domestic consumption? I mean, what to make of that? I mean, why are they going to attack Sweden now? I mean, it's almost idiotic.
They're probably not going to attack Sweden, but Russia is concerned that its NATO border just gotten that much longer, and that more resources will have to be allocated to Russia's planning for an eventual conflict with a high-tech adversary. This is how Russians were describing a potential threat from NATO in 2010 and 2011 in public discussions. So again, this is all about trying to affect the discussion in NATO and in the European Union. And Putin knows that there's a lot of differences in opinion about the war in Ukraine right now across Europe, and he's trying to stoke those differences. I think that's what this really boils down to.
I think it's utterly fascinating, because neither Finland nor Sweden would have joined the alliance if it hadn't been for Russia's illegal and unprovoked second attack on Ukraine. I suppose you don't have anybody to blame but yourself. Sam, honor and pleasure as always having you on. Really appreciate it, and already looking forward to having you back on again to keep talking about a topic that's critically important, I think, for us all on both sides of the Atlantic and around the world. Thanks so very much.
Thanks so much, Margo.
Thank you. And a quick word from our sponsors. The Defense and Aerospace Report and its family of publications is brought to you by General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, HII, GE Aerospace, Bell, Leonardo DRS, and American Rheinmetall. Thanks very much again for joining us, and we'll see you again tomorrow. Until then, have a great day.